From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
National Security, Refining the Differences. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The president and the former vice president could hardly disagree more on the right and wrong policies for keeping America safe. In dueling speeches today, they advanced their views and repudiated each other on issues including interrogations, Guantanamo Bay, and the constitutions. President Obama said he'll protect the nation while preserving the rule of law. Dick Cheney said critics of tough anti-terrorist measures distort the truth. We'll talk to reporters and others about today's quasi-debate. Will it change perceptions of the past 8 years? Will it help shape the future? On Reporter's Notebook later on, how did concealed weapons get into the credit card bill? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. It's been called the debate that was lacking in last year's presidential campaign. We'll hear the contrasting views of President Obama and former Vice President Cheney in dueling speeches today on national security. On Reporter's Notebook, the National Rifle Association flexes its muscles on credit card reform? First, this news update. 4 men have been arrested and charged for conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction in the United States. They were picked up last night in Newburgh, New York, 60 miles north of New York City. Josh Mayer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. And Josh, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hi, Warren.
What, in fact, did these people do?
Well, they are alleged to have planted what they thought were explosives in vehicles in an attempt to blow up one or two synagogues in that small town outside of New York City. But again, these are allegations right now. A lot of this is based on what an informant, a role played by an informant, but the FBI and the New York Police Department certainly believe that these guys were a cell that was intent on conducting bombings and also shooting down aircraft with Stinger missiles.
They actually had missiles?
They did. They had a missile, but it was like the explosives. It was delivered to them by authorities through the informant, and they were disabled beforehand, so there really wasn't anything that they could do with them. So they were inert, as it were, but they did have them.
Questions are already being raised as to what the role of this informant was and whether these people really would have concocted this plot or these plots if it hadn't been for the informant working for the FBI.
Well, that's a good question, and I've written several stories about that in other cases, the Fort Dix case in New Jersey, the case in Miami, several other cases. Informants have played a central role in these cases, paid informants, many of them with criminal backgrounds, and the FBI has acknowledged that this is sort of a double-edged sword, that they need people like this who are familiar with the people that are under investigation to do these kind of investigations, but they say they have to watch them very, very carefully to make sure that they're not engaging in any kind of entrapment efforts. We're trying to goad people into saying or doing things in order to make a case against them and for instance, continue getting paid. The details in this case so far are very sketchy, so we don't know what's happening with this informant. We do know that he had a criminal record, and he'd been working with the FBI for at least 5 years.
The 4 people who were arrested, as I understand it, met in jail?
That's possible. I mean, that's one of the things that we're hearing, but it has not been confirmed yet. But one of them, I think, had been arrested 28 times, so that's very likely or possible that they had. They all seem to have at least some brush with the law over the years.
Is there any connection that they were acting in concert with a terrorist group of some kind?
I think that they've ruled that out, at least for now. I haven't seen or heard any indication of that. I think that they're basically another group of homegrown terrorists. Some experts are calling them a group of guys in which they sort of goad each other into radicalization and in some cases taking that one step further into actually committing or trying to commit attacks.
Was there some philosophical or religious ideology behind this?
One of the guys, Cromedy, claims to have been, his parents were born in Afghanistan, and he says that he doesn't like what the United States military has done in Afghanistan and Pakistan, that has killed many Muslims, and that they wanted to commit jihad, he in particular, to quote, bring death to Jews and also to the United States for what it's done overseas.
So they were apparently then planning to bomb two synagogues in Newburgh. What about the use of the Stinger missile, alleged Stinger, fake Stinger missile that they got? What were they going to do with that?
Well, the synagogues were actually in the Bronx, which is about 60 miles away from Newburgh, where they lived. And it's not clear why they picked the Bronx for that, at least at this point. What was going to happen in Newburgh is there's an air base there in which a lot of planes are going back and forth and helping run supply missions to Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were going to use one of these Stinger missiles, which the United States gave to the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, to shoot down planes. So you can basically fire it off your shoulder and take out a plane.
And again, they thought that they had one of those that they received, again, from the informant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Elaborate a bit, if you will, on what you said earlier about stories you've covered before, where the role of informants turned out to be, was questioned by people who said that perhaps these schemes wouldn't have taken place without them.
Well, in the Fort Dix, New Jersey case, in fact, there were recently just convictions in that, but during the trial and even before the trial, there was a lot of complaints raised by the defense lawyers and the defendants themselves that they were goaded into these attacks by the informant who, was a guy who was trying to work off a criminal sentence, I believe, or had worked it off and was being paid a significant amount of money. And they thought that it was in his financial interest to keep the plot going and also deliver results to the FBI. The FBI denies that, but that's what they contend. The jury apparently felt that the informant's help had contributed enough to gather enough evidence to convict these guys, and I think they're serving very serious, possibly life terms in prison.
And what about the terms that might be assessed to the people that were arrested yesterday?
Well, these guys face life in prison. Each one is charged with two separate counts, and each individual count, conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction within the United States and conspiracy to acquire and use anti-aircraft missiles, each of those has a possible life in prison without parole term for each of these guys. So they're looking at some serious time.
So again, given the background of the cases that you've covered, you would assume at least that the FBI in this case believes that they would have tried to act at least without the help of the informant.
Yes, certainly. That's what they're saying. And also in this case, I think it takes it further than in some of the other cases, such as Fort Dix, for instance, in which case these guys are alleged to have planted what they thought were explosives near two New York City synagogues. So that clearly takes it a step further than some of these other plots. Some of the federal authorities I've talked to, though, however, said that it's more of an aspirational plot than operational.
Josh Meyer with the Los Angeles Times. As always, many thanks. In a moment, national security, refining the differences on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Obama and former Vice President Cheney lined out their differences today in speeches designed to frame the ongoing debate on national security. The president spoke at the National Archives.
I can stand here today as President of the United States and say without exception or equivocation that we do not torture, and that we will vigorously protect our people while forging a strong and durable framework that allows us to fight terrorism while abiding by the rule of law. Make no mistake, if we fail to turn the page on the approach that was taken over the past several years, then I will not be able to say that as President.
President Obama once again speaking at the National Archives. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is White House reporter for the New York Times. Always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Why was it that the president chose this moment and that place to make this speech?
Well, the moment, first of all, the president is being attacked from both the right and the left on a broad range of national security issues. He needs to reclaim control of this debate. Just the other day, Senate Democrats decided to withhold funding that he asked for closing the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So he wanted to make his case. And the place was the soaring rotunda of the National Archives, where the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights are held. And that was, of course, a perfect backdrop for the president's message that, as commander-in-chief, he can do two things at once. He can keep Americans safe, but he can also uphold American values.
And as we just heard him say, fight terrorism while abiding by the rule of law, that was perhaps the most important theme of his speech.
Yes, I would say so. And this is the case that he's trying to make to Americans, and he's going to have to bring some people along because Americans are nervous. The memory of the September 11th attacks, though nearly 8 years old, is still fresh, and there's concern on Capitol Hill and elsewhere that by closing the prison at Guantanamo Bay, detainees who might harm Americans would be released. And so he's got to both reassure people that he can keep Americans safe, but also convince them that it's very important to live up to the moral values that are enshrined in the documents that served as his backdrop.
As our program goes forward, we'll hear what the president and the former vice president had to say about the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Obviously, one of the important issues of this moment that they both wanted to address. Sergei Stolberg, was the White House mindful of the vice president's speech almost simultaneously?
I would certainly say they were mindful of it. They won't fess up to whether or not they scheduled it to compete with Dick Cheney, but let's just say it was fortuitous for the president that he got himself out there as a competing voice, because Dick Cheney is, after all, the most effective and most vocal Republican critic. Some Republicans say he's not a great spokesman for their party, but nonetheless, he commands a lot of attention, and he's out there articulating the opposite view.
There are those who are saying that the Democrats in the Senate who withheld money for closing Guantanamo Bay on the ground that they were worried about prisoners being released into the United States were really setting up a sort of straw man situation where the president could then respond, say what he was going to say, reassure everybody, and then they'd come up with the money. Does that appear to be the case, or does the opposition really seem pretty strongly based?
I think lawmakers really do want a detailed plan from the president before they release that money. They want to know exactly what he's going to do with these terror suspects and where they're going to be housed. I suspect that eventually he will get the money, but I do think he's going to have to come up with a more detailed prescription than he offered today. He says a task force is studying it, and they are reviewing the cases of all the some 240 people who are currently being held at Guantanamo, and will come up with a way to resolve all of them, or most of them.
Again, Cheryl Gay-Stolberg is White House reporter for The New York Times. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Vice President Cheney delivered his address in a very different kind of setting. He was at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a conservative think tank where he's on the board.
In the years since, I've heard occasional speculation that I'm a different man after 9/11. I wouldn't say that, but I'll freely admit that watching a coordinated, devastating attack on our country from an underground bunker at the White House can affect how you view your responsibilities.
Jonathan Landay, a senior national security correspondent with the McClatchy Newspapers. And Jonathan, good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
It was interesting that the vice president from the beginning took this very personal approach toward the national security situation and what was done to stop further attacks, referring more than once to being in the bunker under the White House and watching the buildings come down.
Absolutely. And what we had here was an unrepentant Dick Cheney showing absolutely no remorse for the strategy and the policies that were used by the Bush administration that it says obtained information to help prevent other attacks, but that many other people have serious questions about.
He was very strenuous again in saying not only that other attacks were prevented, but that the Obama administration has information that would demonstrate that if it would only release it.
Well, I have to say that the passage that you cite was one of numerous examples of omissions, exaggerations, and misstatements that the former vice president made in this speech. That statement about the withholding of documents, actually last week, the CIA issued a statement in which it said it was not going to declassify these documents that the former vice president wants to be released to the public, because they are the subject of court proceedings, Freedom of Information Act proceedings, and that under an executive order that was signed by former President Bush in 2003, they are not allowed to make these documents public. So you, on the one hand, you have the former vice president basically accusing the Obama administration of deliberately withholding information from the public, but on the other hand, not talking about the fact that it was the CIA who said they couldn't release these documents under an executive order that was signed by for the former vice president's boss, and that I should say also gave the former vice president the power to classify and declassify information on his own. So he had to be well aware of the guidelines of this executive order when he first asked for these contested documents to be released.
I want to hear more of what both the president and the former vice president said today. But before I do, let me introduce John Eastman. He's dean of the Chapman University School of Law, founding director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, one of those who's been very supportive of John Wu and others who were you and others who were involved in the so-called torture memos. And Dean Eastman, thank you very much for being with us
today. Thank you. And let me start off by saying that not all members of my faculty here at the university agree with me on this. And so I'm speaking on my own behalf, not on behalf of the institution.
Didn't mean to be suggesting anything else.
Yeah.
Do you think it makes a difference with regard to this issue that the vice president raised today about releasing information if, in fact, former President Bush and the vice president himself signed the orders classifying the information?
Well, I'm actually surprised by the comment. Vice President Cheney was not misleading at all on here. The OLC memos were also classified and barred from release by those same orders. The president, and we have a new one, can easily, by executive order, change those old orders. He did it on some of the memos and not on the others. And I think former Vice President Cheney's point was just that you have now given us, quote, less than half the story. And so since you've started us down that path, let's see the whole version. And there is absolutely nothing that prevents President Obama from doing it. He certainly is not bound by President Bush's executive order on this. And so I'm a little surprised by the criticism.
So, Jonathan Lande, the two ways of looking at this.
Well, absolutely. And there are many other examples throughout the speech today of other ways of looking at this. The vice president, the former vice president, made the assertion that, for instance, the abuses that took place at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq were no way connected to the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that were being used by the CIA we know of at least three instances. But in fact, there have been several reports, bipartisan reports, two of them now, issued by the Senate Armed Services Committee that tracks the development, of these techniques at Abu Ghraib, or at least the abuses at Abu Ghraib, directly to these techniques, and names former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other senior officials as being responsible for the fact that these techniques, quote-unquote, migrated from the very upper levels of the American government to Abu Ghraib.
So, John Eastman, the vice president said again today, as has been said before, that it was the work of just a few bad apples at Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, I mean, there's a problem with Jonathan's narrative here. If that was true, then why did we learn of Abu Ghraib from the military itself by way of prosecutions of people committed it? I mean, I know that's the narrative that some people are trying to portray.
Senate Armed Services Committee.
Yeah, but it's just simply not true. You know, I mean, the people were prosecuted and are serving time for violating military rules. They were charged by the military. We learned of those incidents through the military by bringing those charges. If this was part of some grand scheme, the very people that authorize it then turn around the next day and prosecute the people, it makes no sense.
Jonathan Lande, does it make sense?
The professor is taking issue with a bipartisan report issued by a Senate committee, bipartisan, not just the Democrats, but Republicans, who trace these use of the abuses at Abu Ghraib back to decisions that were made at the very upper levels of the American government.
All right. So these two speeches today really touched on a lot of very hot points in the debate going on in the United States and in the Congress, particularly today. Let's take a look at what they had to say about detainees that might possibly be released from Guantanamo Bay into the United States. Here first is Vice President Cheney.
An estimated 14% of those released previously are believed to be back in the business of jihad. I think the president will find upon reflection that to bring the worst of the worst terrorists inside the United States would be cause for great danger and regret in the years to come.
Now, here's what the president had to say about how he's going to decide what to do with the terrorists who are currently at Guantanamo Bay.
As we make these decisions, bear in mind the following fact. Nobody has ever escaped from one of our federal supermax prisons, which hold hundreds of convicted terrorists. As Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, the idea that we cannot find a place to securely house 250-plus detainees within the United States is not rational.
Let me go back to John Eastman, Dean of the Chapman University School of Law. The president said several times today that to say otherwise is to be stoking fear rather than engaging in argument. And we heard him there quote Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, look, I think there's a different issue that the president missed. Putting people in prison requires that we treat this whole thing as if it's some matter of criminal law rather than a matter of war. You don't have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in order to detain combatants. And the model that is reflected in Guantanamo is one that treats them as enemy combatants. Granted, unlawful enemy combatants, because they don't play by the laws of war, but not criminals, which means we don't have to send our troops back into the battlefield to gather evidence for a criminal prosecution. We get to detain these guys simply because they're combatants. And Guantanamo was set up, and it's a multi-million dollar facility set up for precisely that purpose. To transfer them to federal prisons requires that we start treating them as criminals. We go through trials. We have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We simply write this whole thing off as some criminal matter, as if they were trying to bomb the World Trade Center in order to get to the bank vaults underneath, rather than making sustained attacks on the civilian population of the United States as a matter of war.
Let me introduce another guest, Jamil Jaffer, who is director of the ACLU's National Security Project, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren.
How do you respond to what we are hearing now, a new debate about the dispute over what to do with the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and whether or not you can treat them in the courts as a matter of law?
Well, I think that you have to look very specifically at the rules that President Bush proposed and that President Obama is now, to some extent, endorsing. And those are rules that allow for secret evidence, they allow for hearsay, they allow for evidence obtained through coercion. And overall, I'd say that this is a system that is meant to achieve convictions rather than provide fair trials. It gets it exactly backwards. The Bush administration started with the premise that the prisoners had to be convicted, and then it altered the rules to ensure that result. And now, unfortunately, the Obama administration seems to be going down that same road.
All right. You gentlemen are both lawyers, and you wanted to debate the law, and I'm sure we should. But first, quickly, if we can, Mr. Jaffer, what about the idea of imprisoning people that are now in Guantanamo Bay in the supermax prisons in the United States, which the president and apparently Senator Graham as well, I believe, could hold them securely?
I think that it's exactly right. I mean, what should happen with prisoners who are charged with actual criminal offenses, as some of them are. Some of them have been charged with heinous offenses. Those prisoners should be tried in ordinary Article III courts, meaning ordinary federal courts, here inside the United States. Those courts are fully capable of handling those kinds of terrorism cases. And if convicted, the prisoner should serve time in maximum security prisons, supermax prisons, here inside the United States. There's nothing unsafe about that. It's just fear-mongering to suggest that accused or convicted terrorists are going to stage some dramatic escape from, okay, from these prisons. It hasn't happened in the past, and it won't happen in the future.
Fear-mongering, a phrase the president used today. We'll come back and get John Eastman to respond to that. Ask also about the president's reference to the Supreme Court and what it has ruled in this very area. We're going to continue this conversation after a break on Reporter's Notebook, Guns, Credit Cards, and the Democratic Majority. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, once again talking about dueling speeches by President Obama and former Vice President Cheney, which took place today. We're going to get to back to this question of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and how they ought to be treated. But first, just two more sound bites, as we call them in our business, one from the president, one from the former vice president, just to illustrate to our listeners the kind of disagreement we heard today, the way it was laid out, and the passion with which both men presented their points of view.
Even under President Bush, there was recognition among members of his own administration, including a Secretary of State, other senior officials, and many in the military and intelligence community, that those who argued for these tactics were on the wrong side of the debate and the wrong side of history. That's why we must leave these methods where they belong, in the past. They are not who we are, and they are not America.
Referring, of course, to what are referred to as enhanced interrogations, including waterboarding, Vice President Cheney had something to say about that as well, including that it was only used on three people. Here's the way he sounded.
Those are the basic facts on enhanced interrogation. And to call this a program of torture is to libel the dedicated professionals who have saved American lives, and to cast terrorists and murderers as innocent victims. What's more, to completely rule out enhanced interrogation in the future is unwise in the extreme. It is recklessness cloaked in righteousness and would make the American people less safe.
I don't think there's any news in either of those statements, but the way they're expressed, once again, certainly illustrate the depth of the difference between these two men. So let me go back now to John Eastman at Chapman University School of Law and ask you to respond to what we heard earlier from Jamil Jaffer of the ACLU, that, in fact, what President Bush set up and what President Obama now is going forward with is a system that involves a secret evidence, hearsay, evidence that was taken by a coercion, all designed to achieve convictions.
Well, but he's comparing it to our normal criminal trials and then finds them wanting. But in fact, there are more evidentiary protections afforded in the war crimes trials, the military commissions trials, than have ever been afforded by this country or any other country in history to these terrorists who are down in Guantanamo Bay. And so rather than a shortfall, this is an extraordinary amount of process, much greater than Geneva requires, much greater than the Nuremberg process is required. The reason you allow hearsay in war crimes trials is so that you don't force soldiers after clearing a battlefield to have to go back in and take evidence from the battlefield. The reason you allow for secret evidence, as he called it, is a mechanism to allow for top secret information methodologies on intelligence gathering and other to be brought to bear in these war. And that's happened in every war crimes trial that's ever happened in this country or around the world. So these things are no surprise, and the reason President Obama has kept them in place is because there is ample law in support of those methods for trials, in war crimes trials. Now, there's a second piece, and it's critically important to remember that there are two kinds of processes at stake. One is, and again, this has never been required before, but we've been doing it since the beginning in Guantanamo, what we call status review tribunals that assess whether, in fact, they are properly classified as combatants at all. Those are not criminal prosecutions for violating war crimes. That's just to determine whether you're a combatant. And we get to keep you as a detained if you're a combatant. And then the second are for violations of the laws of war. Those are war crimes trials. And again, we've never brought those back to the United States to try in our civilian courts, although we can, because violating the laws of war probably violates many provisions of the U.S. Code as well. But there's a reason those things are kept separate, and that is there's a difference between war crimes of combatants than criminal prosecutions of civilians. And I applaud President Obama for keeping those war crimes trials and commissions in place, because I think it's the right way to go in dealing with war crimes.
Jamil Jaffer with the ACLU, you don't applaud the president. Tell us why.
Right, and I actually think that, not on this one anyway, but I think that it's important to remember who these military commissions are going to be used to try. Nobody objects to the use of a military justice system to try people who were detained on the battlefield and charged with war crimes. There's a time-honored tradition of trying people in military military courts for war crimes. But that's not what's being proposed here. What's being proposed is that people picked up anywhere in the world, some of the people that are proposed to be tried in the system were picked up in Mauritania, they were picked up in Southeast Asia, all over the place. These were people who were picked up nowhere near any conventional battlefield. And the proposal now is to try them in a military justice system, not the traditional military justice system, but rather this completely invented process that's never been used before, that has secured only 3 convictions over the last 7 years, even in its previous incarnation. The proposal is to use this new system to try people who traditionally would have been regarded as criminals, people who have been accused of terrorism-related offenses. And that really is a dramatic shift from where we were before 9/11, and it's something that I don't think any other country has ever done. And in response to the point about these military commissions providing process that is greater than the process that's been provided in the past, well, these military commissions are being introduced because so much of the evidence has been tainted by torture. That's the whole That's the purpose of these commissions, to allow the conviction of suspected terrorists on the basis of evidence that was obtained through torture. And I don't think that there's ever been a trial of this kind in any military justice system in the world that is so reliant on evidence obtained through torture and through cruel and human and degrading treatment. I think it really is a dramatic shift.
Quickly, with regard to the issue of there not having been found anywhere near a conventional battlefield, isn't the argument that this isn't a conventional war, that it's in fact a war that takes place in places like apartments in Hamburg and obviously buildings in New York City, and that consequently that analogy just doesn't hold?
Well, I think that there's some obvious superficial appeal to that argument, but the problem with it is that it's really limitless. If you accept the principle, you accept the proposition that this war really is global, then what's to keep this administration or the next administration from picking somebody up in Peoria, Illinois, as President Bush did, pick somebody up in Peoria, Illinois, and then subject them, rather than to the criminal courts, to this newfangled military tribunal system, which doesn't provide, as even Dean Eastman just acknowledged, doesn't provide the protections that the ordinary criminal courts provide.
John Eastman, back to you. The president today outlined five different categories of prisoners and described how he would deal with them. He didn't mention, though, the reports that many of them were, in fact, innocent people, including teenagers and old men who were turned over because the United States paid a bounty for them in Afghanistan. Have they been weeded out, or are we still talking about them as well?
No, long since weeded out. And what we have remaining in Guantanamo are the people where the evidence is strongest that these are the hardened terrorists. And look, Jamil's comments may sound good in the abstract, but here's what it means on the ground. That means that people who deliberately choose to target civilians, to engage in war by violating the laws of war, who commit the greatest atrocities, like ripping people's heads off with a dull knife and these kind of things, are going to get greater process than the rank and file men in uniform who play by the rules in the conduct of war. That doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to a large majority of Americans that the terrorists, by the way they have conducted the war, are not deserving of greater protections. But we are giving them greater protections, just not as much as we give in the civilian courts to normal criminals.
Let me get Mr. Jaffer to respond to that. Go ahead.
Well, I actually don't. I'm not sure I understand the point, because I'm not proposing that suspected terrorists should be given greater protections than anyone else. I'm just proposing that they be treated as criminals like they are. I think it's a mistake, not only as a civil liberties matter, to allow the administration to invent these new courts that provide lesser protections, but it's also a mistake from a purely policy standpoint, because these kinds of tribunals, which have never been tested before 9/11, these kinds of tribunals have not managed to achieve the convictions that everybody wants. Everybody wants real terrorists to be convicted of their crimes and to serve sentences long sentences in prison. Everybody wants the same thing. But if you look back at the record of this military tribunal system over the last 7 years, it has achieved, as President Obama noted, only three convictions. And one of those was of an Australian who I think is generally regarded to be not somebody who would have been on the top 20 list. Another was of Bin Laden's chauffeur. So this is a system that doesn't have a very good record. And it's highly likely that this new system is going to get bogged down in litigation from the very outset about the legitimacy of the system. And that is something that's going to deprive the country of the convictions that everybody wants to see.
One of the subjects of contention, of course, has been the powers of the White House and of the presidency in times of war and at other times as well. Let's hear one more statement from President Obama today about the powers of his office vis-a-vis the powers of the other branches of government.
In our constitutional system, prolonged detention should not be the decision of any one man. If and when we determine that the United States must hold individuals to keep them from carrying out an act of war, we will do so within a system that involves judicial and congressional oversight. And so going forward, my administration will work with Congress to develop an appropriate legal regime so that our efforts are consistent with our values and our Constitution.
Benjamin Wittes is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of the book Law and the Long War, The Future of Justice in the Age of Terror. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Is what we just heard from President Obama, that he will work with the other branches of Congress, something new and different that we haven't heard for the past 8 years?
Well, it's certainly something very different from both from the prior administration and from what the human rights and civil liberties community and a lot of the president's own base believe, which is to say the prior administration took the view that it could do preventive detention based on the laws of war on its own authority. It generally avoided trying to involve Congress in that, with a few exceptions. And it really fought against the involvement of the judiciary. By contrast, the civil liberties community generally takes the position that preventive detention is illegitimate and that people should either be tried for crimes or released. But this administration has hinted now for some time, and the president today really came out and said that there is going to be a group of Guantanamo detainees who you cannot try and cannot in good conscience release consistent with the national security of the United States. And they're looking to set up, or at least they're thinking about, a working with Congress to create a detention statute supervised by the judiciary that would permit the continued detention of those people. And so that is a very substantial change in policy, probably the most significant thing that the president said in this speech in terms of charting the new direction that he's going to go in.
Jamil Jaffer with the ACLU, what do you have to say about this? Is the president, do you think, trying to co-opt the Congress to do something that you think he ought not to do?
Well, I'm not sure that co-opt is the right word, but we do think it would be a mistake to go down this road towards a preventive detention regime. And there is this there is this meme out there about people who are can't be tried but are nonetheless too dangerous to be released. And I think it's important to ask why it is that these people can't be tried, because I think that the answer, if you scratch beneath the surface here, the answer is almost always that the evidence is tainted through torture. And I think that if, in the end, the only evidence you have of somebody's purported dangerousness is a statement that was literally beaten out of somebody else, then you don't have evidence at all. And we don't think that anyone should be locked up forever on the basis of evidence that was obtained through torture. And that's not something we should apologize for. It's not something that the country should apologize for. The fact that the Justice Department, or the fact that the justice system doesn't allow evidence obtained through torture, that's not a problem with the justice system. It's a reason why we call it the justice system in the first place.
Benjamin Wittes, do you agree that this is the primary reason or the problem, that torture was used, that abusive tactics were used, and that that can't be revealed?
In a word, no. I think there are a lot of reasons why people who may be very legitimately dangerous can't be tried, either in federal courts or in military commissions. The most, in many cases, the most significant is that the conduct that they were engaged in, which would be illegal now under current law, was arguably not illegal at the time that they did it. Specifically, people who took training with Al-Qaeda who weren't Americans, who weren't living in the United States. There are also all sorts of evidentiary problems that inhibit trials that have nothing to do with torture. For example, the circumstances in which material was collected can be, you know, perfectly legitimate for intelligence purposes, but just not the kind of thing, you know, not the way we treat evidence in federal court. And then finally, there's a quantity of evidence issue in a lot of these cases. That in a lot of these cases, you're pretty sure, but not, you don't have anything like proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the person is quite dangerous. And so if you're a president who's taken an oath to protect the country, and the question is, can you hold, you know, do you have a lawful basis to hold that person? And do you, given that you think you do, are you inclined to set that person free? The answer is going to be, well, if you have a legal argument to stand on that the person's a combatant or, so, you know, properly subject to some administrative detention regime, you're going to avail yourself of that, or at least you're going to think pretty hard about it. Whereas if the question is, can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person committed a crime, the answer is probably not. And so there is this gap between the, you know, what a reasonable president who would want to hold under the authorities that he would might legitimately have outside of the criminal justice system and what would be required within it. And those, you know, coerced evidence and torture is one component of that, but it's by no means the only one and probably not the most important.
Jamil Jaffer, what about the prospect of setting up a system so rigorous that you have to release people that you think might, in fact, be dangerous to the United States or its people?
Yeah, I don't think that prospect is very likely, because the system that I'm thinking of is the system we have now, which is the criminal justice system. And the criminal justice system, it's true, requires evidence beyond a reasonable doubt before somebody can be convicted and sentenced. But the substantive criminal laws are so broad, the material support law, for example, is so broad that it's inconceivable that any real terrorist could not be prosecuted under those laws. And Ben is right that that those laws have not always been as broad as they are now. But going back till at least 2001 with the enactment of the Patriot Act, those laws have been sweeping. They really do capture anyone who could conceivably be characterized as an actual terrorist.
Benjamin,
so I don't think that there really is a substantive law problem. And as to the quantity of evidence, but this is I think exactly what we're afraid of, that people will be held, and not just held, but held indefinitely on the basis of evidence that even the administration recognizes is meager. And that's exactly what we're afraid of.
Benjamin Wittes, is that a legitimate fear?
I think it's a very legitimate fear. I mean, I think any time you take the position, and by the way, I do take this position, that it should be proper to detain somebody on the basis of a standard less than the one we're used to in society, which is to say we generally use proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal court. There's risk to that, absolutely. And I think any honest advocate of the policy that the president has outlined today should recognize that. There's risk on the other side, too. And the risk on the other side is that the standards for disabling terrorists become prohibitive as to too prohibitive. And the result is that you're essentially unable to deal with the problem posed by very dangerous people who are actually operating outside of your jurisdiction. And the question in a lot of these areas about the sort of legal structures of counterterrorism are really questions of, you know, risk allocation and what risks are you more comfortable taking and what risks are you less comfortable taking? I think it is, you know, I have believed for some time that there has to be some extra criminal detention authority in this area. I'm not surprised that the president has come to that view. But look, it's the job of the ACLU to argue against that sort of thing and to point out the risks, and there are risks.
All right. We're going to have to leave it at that. Obviously, a lot of subjects to be debated, and many of them defined by the president and the former vice president today. Thank you all so much for being with us. Benjamin Wittes at Brookings, author of Law and the Long War, The Future of Justice in the Age of Terror. Jamil Jaffer at the ACLU. John Eastman at the Chapman University School of Law. Our earlier guests, Jonathan Lande with McClatchy Newspapers and Cheryl Gay Stolberg with the New York Times. When the Democrats took over Congress and the White House, the National Rifle Association warned gun owners they were in trouble. Not working out that way. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. For years, the National Rifle Association has pushed legislation to allow concealed weapons in national parks. Yesterday, it got what it wanted. The House went along with the Senate on an amendment to legislation reforming the credit card industry. The president says he will sign it. Kate Ackley reports on lobbyists for Roll Call, a biweekly that covers Capitol Hill. And Kate Ackley, good to have you on our program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first of all about what actually was put into the credit card bill. What can you do now in a national park that you couldn't do before?
Well, you'll be able to carry a concealed weapon in a national park as long as that's the state law there.
And what's the reason for that?
Well, I guess, you know, the gun rights lobby says they want people to be able to carry their concealed weapons wherever people can go. So that would include national parks.
Now, the Brady Gun Control Organization and others are very much against this, and yet they couldn't keep it out of the credit card bill.
They couldn't, and groups like the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence and other gun control lobbying groups thought that this was going to be their opportunity with the Democrats in control of the White House and the Senate and the House, but that just has not turned out to be the playing field that that's to their advantage after all.
Why did they choose the credit card bill?
Well, it was a top priority for President Obama. It was a legislative vehicle that was definitely moving, and the Senator Tom Coburn put the amendment on this bill in the Senate. It passed the Senate, and the House of Representatives decided it just wasn't worth fighting. There's a bipartisan basically majority in the House that supports Second Amendment gun rights.
And that's true also in the Senate, where Senator Coburn of Oklahoma was able to get this amendment attached to the bill?
That's correct.
So there's no rule then that says the amendment has to relate to the same subject as the main part of the bill?
In the Senate. In the Senate, you can put on an amendment about anything, and it passed the Senate, obviously, and the House decided to go ahead and just pass the bill as it was so that it could go to the president's desk. And President Obama is expected to sign the bill over the weekend by Memorial Day.
How did the NRA get to be so strong? Let's start out in the Senate, where the Democrats have not a big majority, but, well, they do have a big majority. It's almost to 60.
Well, you've seen the election of a lot of more conservative Democrats who have lobbied or who have said that they are more in line with the NRA lobby. They want people to be able to hunt. They don't want to take away anybody's guns. They don't want to be viewed as the party of the early 90s, the Democratic Party of the early 90s that wanted gun control measures and so forth. So you've just seen more Democrats embracing hunting and the right to bear arms, basically.
Well, does this mean if you can carry a concealed weapon in a national park, can you also hunt there?
That I don't know. That's a good question, and I think that that's a separate issue. But it's more about being able to just carry your firearm that you already have. I think hunting is going to have to be dealt with in that would be another matter. So
but this is not the point I was trying to make was this is not a matter where they defeated an effort by the gun control lobby to limit hunting or take away guns or something like that. It's exactly the reverse.
This was a proactive measure supported by the pro-gun lobby, the NRA, etc.
And now back in the House, the majority of Democrats in the House is pretty big as well. Are they worried about the NRA coming after them with advertisements saying that if they didn't vote in favor of concealed weapons in national parks, that they were somehow anti-gun and ought to be defeated?
I think that's exactly right. You see, the more conservative Democrats from southern states, Mountain West, some places in the Midwest, wanting to make sure that they're in good standing with the NRA so that they don't have to face negative advertising when it comes to election time again. So they're obviously keeping that in mind.
Was there any active lobby of citizens other than the NRA that came to Congress and said, boy, do we want to carry concealed weapons in national parks?
Well, I think so. And the National Rifle Association is, it has a collection of people. It's, it's like 4 million members, and their membership has increased 30% since the November elections, which gave Democrats control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. So those are a lot of individual citizens who are obviously active on this issue, and they, I'm sure, have been calling their members of Congress as well.
And it shows you how adroit the NRA is. They're people who I think would be perhaps joined because they were fearful that with a Democratic majority, the gun rights might be limited rather than expanded, which is what we're seeing. What's next for the NRA?
Well, they've got a list of proactive, they have things that they're lobbying and pushing for. But one of their main things that they want to try to hold off. They don't want to see a reauthorization of the assault weapons ban. They don't want that. So that's something that could be down, you know, in the next few months or weeks. That could be something that they actually have to play defense on.
Has that, in fact, expired, or is it about to expire?
As far as I know, that has expired.
It has expired, and so they want to prevent it from being put back into effect. And what about Washington, D.C.? There's an issue there as well that Congress has to do with.
That's right. That there is the District of Columbia is trying to get a full voting member of Congress, which has pretty widespread support now throughout the Congress. But there is, like with the credit card matter, there is kind of an unrelated amendment that is related to gun control legislation in the District of Columbia. That is holding up that that entire measure. So,
well, Kate Eckley, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Staff writer covers the lobbying beat for Roll Call, again, biweekly, that covers the Congress. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Karen Radziner and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.